welcome into a Tuesday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. I'm your host, co-host, a little too generous there. I'm your co-host, Gavin Shaw, and I'm fresh off 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns back in Arizona, but I couldn't resist an offer to move back to my native New York to cover your Brooklyn Nets, and I'm joined by the financial expert, the lifelong fan, the Curb Your Enthusiasm enthusiast, Josh Bass. Josh, how we doing?
Gavin, I am doing very well. Haven't had Nets basketball these past 2 days, and it's kind of been nice to relax and rewind and focus on some family time while we before we get back into the swing of things, you know?
How's Barry doing? And your father.
Well, you talk about this off air.
Your father, Barry, how's he doing?
He doesn't like his name being mentioned on the podcast.
Okay. All right.
He doesn't listen either, but.
Oh, that's a real double whammy. All right. We're going to get into the Nets' last game, which was similarly depressing to their last couple, a 109-97 defeat against the Indiana Pacers. But first, Josh, you begged me to talk about it on air. I attended the NBA Christmas party last Wednesday via...
Whoa, wait, hold on. Was it Christmas or was it non-denomination?
I know, it's non-denomination.
Okay,
our friend Mark, who invited us, referred to it as a Christmas party, and I stuck with that. Anyways, yeah, that was it was a great time. It was really cool. The stars were out. The people I recognized there... Dikembe Mutombo, Isaiah Thomas, Adam Silver, David Stern. Adam Silver, just as nice as you'd think he is. I was taking a picture of our friend and his coworkers with Adam, and Adam's like, "Oh, I'm sure you want to be in one." That could have just been like self-serving on his part. Maybe he just assumes everyone wants to take a picture with him. But he kind of drew me in, took a big picture, handed the phone back to our other friend. Just a real everyman, except for the fact that he's like 6'4", maybe.
Wait, was this a funny story? Because when you said that you wanted to talk about the Christmas party or the non-denominational party, I assumed you had some good content. But
that's pretty funny, right? Nice guy. Nice
guy.
All right. Let me up the ante for you. All right, David Stern taking pictures of like everyone, and then me and two others go up to take a picture with him. And he's like, "Oh, my wife is going to effing kill me." And then he just walks away from us.
That's fine.
Better. Okay, all right. Let me up the end. How do you feel about Dikembe Mutombo dancing on stage while the fourth leading singer in the band Maroon 5 performed?
Yeah, I feel pretty good about it. So okay. The fourth out of five lead singers.
Yeah, it's Maroon 4 is his code name.
Second to last.
Yeah, he's the second to last one, but Adam Silver was really is they apparently they'd gotten Joe Jonas the year before, but and Adam Silver like introduced him like, "We're gonna do it even bigger this year, the fourth leading singer in Maroon 5, and then whatever his name was.
Did you know Joe Jonas is in the remake of Jumanji?
Is that true?
Yeah, it's him and The Rock are like the lead people in it.
Oh, that's amazing.
That movie was
Are you sure about that?
My childhood. Yes, I'm positive.
Okay, because I know him and I know Jack Black's in it, and I know The Rock's in it, and I know Kevin Hart's in it, so I can't imagine.
Sorry, Nick Jonas.
Nick Jonas. Okay, that makes more sense. All right. I kind of like that. I'm trying to think if anything else happened. We were going to take a picture with Isaiah Thomas, but we're both longtime Knicks fans, and I realized I probably wouldn't have said anything nice to him, so we decided against that. Food was good. They had a short rib ravioli. That would have been very up your alley, Josh. And, they let you take pictures in funny sweaters, and Josh will be pleased to know I took mine in a Nets sweater, and we can tweet that out on the official account. All right, that's about all I had on the NBA Christmas party. I hope you're invigorated by that and ready to go.
Riveting stuff, as always, Gavin.
All right, really appreciate it. Okay, Nets, Pacers. My big takeaway from this game is, like, the Pacers just kind of felt like a better version of the Nets and, like, kind of what the Nets are trying to become. Like, even though they didn't take a ton this night, both teams, like, really play like kind of similarly. Like they get up and down. They usually take a lot of threes. The Pacers only 18 on the night. And both are kind of fueled by their youth movement. Both have like two prime young prospects in the Nets case, Caris LeVert, Jared Allen. In the Pacers case, the slightly older Victor Oladipo, combined with DeMontis Sabonis, or no, Miles Turner, I guess, ranks ahead of him on that scale. But it's kind of interesting. I think these teams are built the same way. The Pacers just had more talent and played harder for my money in this game, and that proved to be the difference.
Yeah, I mean, the Pacers definitely had that blue-chip guy that the Nets are lacking since Oladipo has really emerged into an all-star player and outperformed any expectations, any reasonable expectations that could have been set for him once he came back to Indiana. And then Pacers got two great performances off the bench from Sabonis, who's been a revelation this year, 17-8 for him, and then Corey Joseph, who always seems to play well against the Nets. He's a steady presence, and between him and Collison, the Pacers got 40 minutes of very solid point guard play, only one turnover between the two of them, and they were really able to outshine the Nets team that Allen Crabbe got hot in the first half, but besides that, didn't really seem to have a spark much of the game.
Yeah, no, Crabbe scoring 14 points in the opening quarter, it was just like really like electric, and I think it was kind of interesting that him and Quincy Acey had maybe not Crabbe's best game of the year, but two of their best games of the year right after we kind of ripped into both of them on our award show. So I'd like to take a little bit of credit for that, and maybe...
I know. I still need to rip into Crabbe, because outside of that first quarter, he
didn't do anything. Yeah.
3 points, only took three shots. You'd think the guy would be more aggressive. And that's my big problem with the guy, that when he gets hot, teams adjust to him, and then he doesn't make that adjustment back, so he just is completely taken out of the game at that point.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% with you. Not to stray too far into Pacers talk, but I feel kind of vindicated on Sabonis, because I loved his game coming out of college, and I thought the Thunder, if they could figure out how to make him fit, spoiler, they didn't. He was going to be a real steal for them. And then now he goes to Indiana, and he was just like bullying Jared Allen. He's bullying Tyler Zeller. He's just like, he's kind of like a classic center, but like just skilled enough that he could kind of play in any era pretty successfully and play in any offense and play in any spot. He's just like a really good young player. And I have a feeling at some point in his career, he's going to be kind of an essential component on a really good team.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy, because obviously last year spent so much time outside, but he really does have incredible hands and can really catch the ball on the move and finish with very good touch inside. He was more of a post-up guy in college, but he's really learned how to play in the paint and finish off floaters, finish through contact, and he's done a great job this season. Pacers fans should be really excited to have him in the fold. I've been really impressed. I didn't know how his game was going to translate in the NBA, but he's done a really nice job in his second season, proving that he does belong.
Yeah, and obviously it helps to play against the Nets, but it seems like every meaningful guy on the Pacers shot the ball well, and you can tell why this team has been legitimately very solid this whole season. They just have such a diversity of weapons on offense. Obviously, Bojan Bogdanovic making his return to Brooklyn, he looked really smooth. Miles Turner, it felt like he was quiet the whole game, and then you look at the box score, 16-6, 2 blocks, 7 of 11 from the field. Victor Oladipo, a quiet 26 points outside of that one epic alley-oop in the game's closing minutes. And then you mentioned it, Kojo and Sabonis both scoring the ball efficiently. Yeah, and then on the Nets side of thing, it was just kind of disappointing. Like, I just, after that Toronto embarrassment, I really expected Kenny Atkinson to have this team humming, and fueled by Crabbe, they came out pretty strong in the first quarter. But I don't know, Josh, tell me if you're noticing this too. I feel like this has been a little bit of a trend over the last few games, and again, it could be fatigue, but I don't think this team has been playing with the intensity they need to win games. Like, given their talent deficit they face on a night-to-night basis, they need to be winning in the effort category every single night, and I feel like Indy was just going harder than them for like large chunks of the games, and the Nets would have like spurts where they'd match it, but it just wasn't really sustained at any point.
Well, you know, maybe they are tired. I mean, a guy like Spencer Dinwiddie has had to carry such an enormous load this season, and he really hasn't been used to that since college, and it's been a few years since that. He's had an ACL injury since then. Even Caris LeVert battled injuries in college. Didn't play a ton last season because he was getting eased back into action, and now he's playing 30 minutes a game. You know, these guys might be tired from having to do so much ball handling work, especially when you have wings like Joe Harris and Allen Crabbe that aren't traditional creators and have to be set up a lot of the time. I mean, I can see why these guys definitely need a break, and if D'Angelo Russell can come back soon, that would help to ease a lot of that pressure.
Yeah, so arguably the Nets' three best players this year, Damari Carroll, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Spencer Dinwiddie, going a combined 4 for 22 from the floor. So that's a pretty good way to score under 100 points for only the sixth time this season and to lose the game. One thing I liked, Dinwiddie and Zeller continuing to show off their obscene chemistry. Dinwiddie having 9 assists despite not scoring really well. And that's kind of a credit to the telepathy those two have developed. They're turning into a really good combo. And I think because of it, Zeller's going to be a big part of this rotation all year. And you kind of saw what Kenny Atkinson maybe wants to do in a normal game with his center rotation, because Jahlil Okafor didn't even get in tonight. And you just saw a combination of Allen, Zeller, and then them going small a couple of times at the five spot.
Yeah. One question I would have for you, Gavin, is Nets were down by about 6 to 8 points end of this game. Spencer Dinwiddie was still on the bench. I know that he didn't have a great game, especially shooting the ball 0-for-5 from 3, but has he deserved that respect, in your opinion, to be on the court in crunch time, no matter how he's played, especially with D'Angelo Russell out? Or were you okay with Caris LeVert manning the point guard spot?
You know, I'm kind of torn on it because, and I want to talk about this article more in depth the next time we do a podcast, but The Ringer came out with a really good article in the Brooklyn Nets today. And at the beginning, there's a wonderful pull quote from Kenny Atkinson where he says, you know what, we're just trying shit. The beginning of that might have been a paraphrase. The end most certainly was not. So I kind of like the idea of them experimenting with lineups, like even at the end of games, because if we're being honest with ourselves, like this Nets team, barring just like a run of injuries throughout the East, they're not going to make the playoffs, and they're probably, I mean, or at least 3 games ago, they were probably as close to the playoffs as they're going to be this season. Why not like experiment at the end of games, particularly one where Caris LeVert is playing so well with the ball in his hands? Like he didn't have a great game, but he did have a great fourth quarter, like just attacking the basket, play in, play out, contorting his body, fabulous finishes. And I think Kenny Atkinson wanted to put this game kind of on his shoulders and said, you know what, if we're going to come back in it, let Caris control the basketball. Not that Dinwiddie's like a dominating presence and he can play off ball and be effective, and he probably would have been their best option in that spot, so that's the only reason I question it. But I think Atkinson really wanted to test Caris LeVert in that type of setting, or maybe I'm reading too much into it. We've talked about at times KA not necessarily being aware enough to make in-game changes that we think are smart, so it could have been a little bit of that, but I leaned more towards the fact that he was trying to put on Caris LeVert's shoulders, and I kind of like that decision, and I like letting the young guy have that kind of responsibility.
Yeah, I think that you made a good argument. Like, I guess there is really no downside in letting LeVert run the show in crunch time and seeing what happens, especially because wins like aren't the best indicator of success for this kind of team. I think it's a balancing act going forward, especially if Russell does come back soon, and with the Nets history with not rushing people back from injuries, who knows? But I think you have a balance there of how to get guys on the floor in crunch time, how to give them those reps, especially when you have a bunch of guys that are talented and have future potential, but no one has really separated themselves from the pack. Like, eventually someone has to do that, or else it's kind of going to be a morass of mediocrity.
All right, coming up next on the Locked On Nets podcast, we are going to talk about the team's game tonight. By the time you're listening to this, against the Sacramento Kings, who are coming off a big win over the Philadelphia 76ers. But Josh, first, I want to wrap up this Pacers game with a couple of final thoughts. Nick Stauskas, 15 minutes, 0-for-5 from the field, and the way we've talked about him, and I think it's a fair way to talk about him based on how he's played his whole career, is he was kind of embodying some of the worst qualities of Alan Crabb, in that he's really dynamic when he's draining threes and he's hitting step backs and he's nailing them with guys in his face. But then when he's not doing that, he's not really doing a lot. And today, 15 minutes, 0-for-5 from the field, 0-for-2 from 3-point range, no rebounds, no steals, no blocks. But he did move the ball pretty well, had 3 pretty nice assists. So I don't want to call it a total loss for him, but I'm wondering how permanent of a fixture he is in this Nets rotation. In this particular game, they did have, unless I'm missing anyone obvious outside of D'Lo and Jeremy Lin, they had their full rotation healthy, and he was still a fairly significant part of it But coaches in the past, anytime Stauskas has gone on a cold stretch of more than one game, he's kind of been benched. So I'm wondering how long Kenny Atkinson sticks with him in this Nets rotation.
Yeah, I mean, Atkinson likes to play around with his rotations. If Stauskas can, obviously his value can be tied to his shooting, as you mentioned. But I think that if he can at least like understand the system and play hard, then he's going to get some time. But if he's not hitting shots at the end of the day, he's not really going to be a part of this rotation. And Kenny Atkinson is very fluid with that. So even if he falls out, he'll get another chance at some point this year. But I don't think anyone was expecting Stauskas to be a savior for this Nets team when he came into the fold. But who knows? Maybe if Joe Harris is traded at the deadline, he'll get more playing time. But listen, this is a guy that did play 80 games last year for the Sixers, averaged 27 minutes in those games, a lot higher than I thought. So if he's gotten some time in the NBA to prove himself, he just needs a change of scenery, and hopefully that will help him show a little bit more of his game. But if not, you know, he's making like $4 or $5 million this year, so I'm not gonna be too upset with him.
No, he's living a pretty good life, as is just about everyone in the league. But I'm always kind of torn on like what team should do with those shoot only guys. Like, I know this was a big deal, like when Steve Novak was running around the league, and just like there are so many. Those guys are kind of a dime a dozen in the NBA, like that are just elite shooters, but can't really do anything else. And I always kind of feel sympathetic to their cause as someone who would describe their game similarly, if you take the elite out of the description. But it's tough for those guys. If you don't play a lot and you don't play consistently, it's almost impossible to shoot the ball really well in that setting where you're so reliant on rhythm, because you never really have time to set up your shot. There are guys constantly running out on you. You're constantly catching, firing within the same millisecond. And if you don't play a lot, it's hard to just come off the bench cold and hit a couple threes in a row. If it's like the fourth game in 5 nights and your coach is just trying something by putting you in. That being said, I mean, there's a reason those guys don't play more. And if you don't diversify your game, you're not really an asset or in like a kind of holistic sense. So I know that was a long, semi-incoherent diatribe, but I'm always interested to see how those guys' careers go and whether Stauskas could ever be more than just a shooter.
Well, he also has to prove that he can be a shooter. I mean, for his career, shooting under 35% from three.
Yeah, that's fair.
He's living off his reputation at this point, and he would be playing more if he was up to that 40% three-point shooting that people expected out of him coming from Michigan. Then there wouldn't really be a problem. He'd be delivering on some of the value that Sacramento expected when they took him with the 8th overall pick. But the problem is he can't do anything else, and he hasn't been as good of a shooter as they thought. So,
right, but
one or the other.
Yeah, no, I guess. My only counter there is, again, like, you have to play a lot to be in that kind of rhythm. And he shot 37% in Philly, like, the only year in his career. Oh, I guess the season before he got sustained minutes.
But he's honestly, he's gotten time.
Yeah. No, I'm looking at his career stats. He did play 25 minutes his first year in Philly. But last year, again, playing almost 30 minutes a game, shot 37% from three. So I think he's proven that if he's not an elite shooter, he's a good one. But again, if you're a good one and you don't do anything else, you're not all that valuable. So I ultimately see your side of the argument, Josh.
Hold on. Honestly, if that video, the video of him shooting in his backyard where he made like 90 out of 100 threes,
yeah,
if that never came out, he would be out of the league at this point.
You think so? I don't know, because the whole thing with him in college was, and we're going way too far down this Nick Stauskas rabbit hole, but the thing with him in college was that he was like a good all-around player. Like, he could attack the basket, he was athletic, he could rebound, he could pass, and you know that.
Right,
just
no, he definitely was, you're right, but this is his fourth year and he hasn't been.
Yeah, no, you're right, you're right. I'm not really arguing with you. I just, like, he was just someone I liked a lot, and I feel bad that he's not better than he is, I guess. Anyways, I hinted at it earlier, and we made like a brief mention of it, but what do you make of Jahlil Okafor not playing? You know what, Josh, before you answer that, let me just remind everyone listening to leave a 5-star review for Locked On Nets. Just head over to iTunes. There'll be a section on the podcast play. Leave a rating. Leave a review. We've used up all of our burner accounts, have left quite a few. I think iTunes is starting to catch on to us. So we'd really appreciate if some real people gave it a look, gave it a chance. And it really does help the podcast and help us continue to make the podcast. So head over to iTunes, leave 5 stars, and write whatever you want. Maybe make it funny. Anyways, Josh, Jahlil Okafor not playing in this game. What do you make of that?
I mean, I think a lot of the press that came out of the last 24, 48 hours or so. Talked a lot about Jahlil Okafor's conditioning. And it seems like the Nets aren't comfortable with where he was. And then he seems like he knows that he has a lot of work to do. So it seems like he's not really going to play for the next couple of games until he can work his way back into game shape. I'm not sure how you do that without playing in games. But from what it seems like, if I can find the quote here, Kenny Atkinson said about the game on Friday against the Raptors of Okafor, we needed kind of like a barometer of where he is. Toronto gave us some information. So
that's interesting.
Seems like they were just throwing him out there, seeing what happens, and now they're going to work from there using that as a baseline. So I think that's kind of weird, to be honest. But I'll trust Kenny Atkinson and Sean Marks. What do you think of this?
You know, I think the obvious solution there is to like give him like a Long Island Nets stint. And I guess like the only reason not to would be it'd be kind of embarrassing for like the number three pick in the draft. But it is almost like he's coming off injury, like not playing all year. And I think in that game, like you saw there were moments where he was kind of picking his spots and was like he was a little bit unsure of himself. That's kind of the whole point of having a G League team, is to have like a farm system that's running your style of offense. And if you need someone to adapt to the team or get back in conditioning, or in Jahlil Okafor's case, I think regain some confidence, I think that's the perfect setting to let him go down there, have a couple of 30 and 15 games, and then come back up with renewed confidence, superior conditioning, and having a better feel of what the Nets like to do on offense and getting to play big minutes in a low pressure setting. To me, that seems like the perfect answer.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I think that he's already been embarrassed enough where there's no, he's already hit rock bottom. I mean, going to the G League isn't going to do anything, but it seems like Kenny Atkinson has kind of ruled that out, says he wants to do it with the big team and that they're going to try to create some game situations. I don't know. It's tough. I mean, depends how much of an investment they want to make in Okafor. Obviously, as we talked about in this podcast, Jared Allen is the center of the future. He is much more suited for a modern game. He has worlds more of defensive potential than Okafor. But Okafor, he's much better at the things that he specializes in. That's scoring inside. Obviously, he needs to play to do those things. So we'll see what happens. When do you think we're next going to see Okafor in a game? Because this is so bizarre to me, this whole situation.
Yeah, it is kind of weird because it's interesting because I think you and me or me more so than you, but like a lot of Nets people kind of latched onto Okafor as like the golden gem in that trade, when I think maybe some there were a lot of other writers, like national writers, who more saw that as a trade for the Nets to get that second round pick. And Okafor taking a flyer on him was kind of secondary. And I thought that was kind of ridiculous, just because I think Okafor is still really, really talented. But it will be interesting to figure out if we're going to see that side of him this season, and if he's going to get the minutes to really prove it. Because this isn't a system that's ever going to be structured around him. And it sounds weird to say on a team that's not super talented, but there are a lot of mouths to feed just because of how Kenny Atkinson has structured his rotation and certain guys stepping up. So I'm wondering if even as the focal point of a bench unit, if that's really feasible for him. And I guess we're going to find out one way or another. But to your point about Jared Allen being the center of the future, I still think that leaves like a very logical spot for Okafor, because Allen, I mean, he's a long way to go. Maybe at some point he will be. I don't think he's ever going to be that guy who's a dominant offensive player. Like I look at like a Rudy Gobert, DeAndre Jordan type role with maybe a little bit more offensive diversity is kind of his ceiling. So then you can still use a guy like Okafor off the bench who just can come in and attack back up big. So I think those two could actually fit off each other pretty well. The only issue is, and we saw a little bit of this in the first game, someone like Tyler Zeller is just a much more natural fit for how the Nets play. And like when the Nets have Okafor in, they kind of have to pervert what they do on offense to structure it around him.
Yeah, I also think I feel like I wish this plan was communicated more when the trade was made, instead of letting a week and a few games go by and saying like, oh, maybe he'll play tonight, who knows, then him finally getting in a game and now this whole reevaluating where he's at. But going back to that Okafor and Allen point, I feel like when a team tries to develop two young players at the same position at once, it never really works out. You think of Denver with Jusuf Nurkić and Nikola Jokic. Trying to think about this. I feel like Phoenix with Marquise Chriss and Dragan Bender has been a disaster so far. I think like one either rises above the other, or they both fail. Like you never really see it where two players become successful on the same team that they're developing on.
Well, the only counter argument I'd make to that is, and we've spent way too much time on this, so we'll get onto the Kings shortly. But the only counter argument I'd make to that is, I think it works if the guy who's clearly second on the totem pole, and in those two situations, like the issue was, and the issue still is for Phoenix, that no one is clearly second on the totem pole. But if Okafor knows that he's the backup and Allen knows that he's the starter, and Okafor can swallow his ego enough to the point that he's okay with that, and who knows, and like, I think,
but
maybe
Gavin, we just did the same thing in Philly with Okafor, Nerlens Noel, and Embiid.
But I don't know, like, I like, could Philly have made that work and like used Okafor as a backup big? Like, I think that situation like went wrong because they weren't playing him at all, and like there could be a number of issues there. That, like, I mean, because essentially, like, what you're saying, if, like, that's your argument, is that Okafor, like, there's not really a system he could fit into. Because I guess my core point is, like, I don't think he's ever going to be a starter on a good team in the NBA unless his defense gets dramatically better, like, way better than I think it could get. He's not starting anywhere anyways, so, like, why not be a backup on the Nets? Like, a team that likes to play a big rotation, like a situation where he'd still play 20 minutes a game and his contributions would really, really be valued. Like, I'm just saying he's in for a rude awakening if his expectation is, you know what, I'm going to leave Brooklyn. They have Jared Allen, and I'm going to go start somewhere else. If you're not going to beat out Jared Allen at this point in his career, then you're not really going to start anywhere in the league. That's as far as I'll go with that.
Yeah, I think that at this point in Okafor's career, he's in an awkward position because he still has that draft pedigree, third overall pick, All-American at Duke. But I think until he gets some years in the league, it might take him a while to realize that he might not ever be a quality starter in this league.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you.
It might be hard for him to reconcile seeing a guy like Jared Allen, who's a rookie, 22nd overall pick this year, and say, hey, I know I'm better than this guy. I was drafted 19 spots before him. I was an All-American, all of my accolades. Why am I not going to be playing above him?
Yeah, and it's such a weird phenomena because maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'd bet if they played like one-on-one in practice, like Jahlil Okafor would like kick Jared Allen's butt. But so much of the NBA is context, and Okafor just doesn't fit into it. So you're right, it's a weird place. I'm sure I can't imagine what it's like for him. But as we said with Stauskas, these guys have it pretty good anyway, so you can't feel too bad for them. Speaking of feeling bad for people slash entities, the Sacramento Kings coming into town, fresh off a big win tonight. We are recording on Tuesday over the Philadelphia 76ers in Philly. So that's pretty impressive. On the whole, the Kings haven't been very good this season. Their record isn't awful. They're, let me look, 10-20 on the year, but their point differential.
That's pretty awful.
Yeah, not great. And their point differential is awful. It's -9 by more than 1.5 points, the worst in the entire NBA over the Chicago Bulls. So they've been by that metric at least the worst team in the NBA. And they're just they're a weird confluence of really, really young guys like similar to Phoenix, and then vets who are way past their prime. So this is a game the Nets should win. And if you want to get out of a 3-game losing streak, or any kind of losing streak, now is kind of the time for the Brooklyn Nets, because after this game, the schedule really does heat up. They take on Washington at home. They take on this Pacers team that just ran them on the road. Then the Spurs on the road. Then the Pelicans. And I can just imagine Boogie Cousins and Anthony Davis combining for like 60 and 30 in that game. Then they play the Heat on the road, which is always tough in Miami's building. And then Boston on the road. So this could turn into like a 7-8 game, 9-10 game losing streak if they can't beat the Kings tomorrow. So I think this is a really crucial game for the Nets.
Oh, certainly. I mean, listen, the Nets aren't going to be playing a lot of teams this year where they might be more talented than. So they need to take advantage of this, especially at home. It's going to be nice to see Vince Carter back.
Yeah, that'll be cool.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. I think, I don't know, Zach Randolph had a great season for the Kings. Absolute renaissance year for them. I think if RHJ is going to be the primary matchup on him, that could be tough. RHJ could guard Willie Cauley-Stein, and then Zeller would guard Randolph, just have a little bit more size on him. But he's been great this year, averaging 15 points on 51% shooting. He had that great game against, who was it? Who was it where he was just draining threes against? It was New Orleans, where he got into a huge fight with DeMarcus Cousins. George Hill out with an illness tonight against the Sixers. I'm not sure if he's going to play against the Nets, but he's been on fire lately. Very efficient. Buddy Hield's been really good for them this year. Also, much improved. I'm sure you're happy about that, Gavin.
Yeah. He's been good off the bench. And to your Zach Randolph point, I don't know if you saw, in 28 minutes tonight, he had 27-5. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I mean, he's their starting power forward. He's been awesome this year. He's a 21 PER, hitting threes, is doing damage inside.
That's ridiculous. I really thought he was washed last year.
So did I. I mean, it's great to see him do well. I mean, he still averaged 14-8 last year. Obviously, his efficiency was pretty trash, but listen, he's a pro. I think that the Nets can't be too overconfident with these guys, especially on the losing streak that they're on, because they do have a lot of firepower. But if Spencer Dinwiddie can come out and execute, and guys like Caris LeVert and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson don't turn it over, shoot efficiently, I think the Nets are going to do pretty well in this game. Again, I think Tyler Zeller should continue his strong play, because the Kings don't really have a ton of inside presence that can deter him on pick and roll dives.
All right, Josh, I have to throw out one, not really and I told you so, because you didn't like totally hate it, but you gave me a little bit of crap rewinding about 5 months when we had our NBA mock draft this past summer. I selected one Frank Mason for the Brooklyn Nets, and you were like less than excited about it. To be fair, I think the guy you might have wanted was Kyle Kuzma, so you would have been absolutely right in that assessment. But Frank Mason, only shooting 39% from the field, but take that out of account. He's been pretty darn good, 42% from three-point range, 78% from the charity stripe, averaging 3 assists per game. And I see like one clip every night where he's just destroying a guy on the dribble. So I don't think he's ever going to be a great NBA player, but he's going to be a nice backup point guard, and that's exactly what I wanted. And the Nets have proven that they didn't really need it with Spencer Dinwiddie there. But with all the injuries, he might have actually played a role on this Nets team this year. So that's kind of an interesting little sliding door.
I mean, I'm not going to get too excited over Frank Mason.
39% from the field, Josh.
Is that a selling point?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, I think he's going to be a solid backup point guard. Very talented offensively. I'm sure he's giving back everything he's
scored. No, he's a good defensive player. Dude, he's intense on defense.
It was intense, but he's like 5'10", guys.
He's a rugrat. He's constantly hitting you.
Okay. No, I'm excited to see him tomorrow. I mean, he's a great college player. I think I'm happy with the Nets selection of Jared Allen. They kept their pick at 27. I would have liked to see them take Kuzma. I'm not even sure who I said at the time. I probably said like Justin Patton or someone who's turned out to be pretty bad.
No, I think you wanted them to take Vasenkov at 27, but they got him in the second round, so you're still happy.
Love this thing, Kyle.
Yeah, the future, as we call him.
The LeBron of Cyprus.
All right, that's a good note to end on. For Josh, I'm Gavin. We'll probably be back on Thursday recapping that Kings game for you. Until then, keep it with Locked On Nets.